From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nico Muhly's work defies category. A contemporary classical composer and arranger, Muhly has written operas, collaborated with pop musicians, put out albums of sacred choral music, scored for films, and written for the ballet, all with a distinctive new voice in an old tradition. This hour on Point, contemporary classical composer Nico Muhly channeling the sound of our time. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you hear captured, reflected in the music of Nico Muhly? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Nico Muhly, contemporary classical composer who seems to do it all. He's 33, was commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera in 2008 to write Two Boys, the youngest composer ever commissioned by the Met. He's working on another opera commission, Marnie, for the Met. He's worked with a long list of ensembles, ballet companies, soloists, symphonies, and with wider-ranging artists, Bjork, rock band Grizzly Bear, R&B artist Usher, and illustrator Myra Kalman, just to name a few. We're so glad he's here with us today. Nico Muhly, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Of all the things you could do with your musical talent, what took you down this road toward this funny thing called contemporary classical, Nico?
It's a strange thing. I find myself having to explain myself all the time to strangers.
Sure you do, and yeah.
Sitting next to someone on the plane or whatever. I mean, really, it was an outgrowth of just a kind of... I would say mediocre musicianship as a child, as a preteen. I was sort of 10, 11, 12, and, you know, playing the piano as everyone does. And I was also singing in a choir. And I think I was okay at it. And then suddenly, all of a sudden, in about 2 weeks, I got really good at both things and got kind of obsessed. And it was the energy of that obsession that sort of carried me from then to right now.
That childhood in Rhode Island, I mean, listeners responded, it's funny, right away, we've got this, Bob says, is it difficult to be taken seriously as a classical composer who's not dead? I mean, people struggle with, if it's classical, shouldn't it be old? I mean, what does this even mean to you to be called a contemporary classical composer, Nico?
Well, I think, I mean, classical has to do, I mean, the label classical has more to do with the venues in which the music is performed and the tradition from which it derives its power. You know, I don't think it really has anything to do with how it sounds, but much more to do with how it's organized, how it's paid for to a certain extent, and the environment in which the music will be heard and received. That having been said, you know, these things have been in constant flux even during the classical period, by which I mean sort of Mozart through Beethoven. You know, it's an ever-changing thing.
For out of venues and tradition, let's listen to one of your pieces and think about it in just those terms. This is from your 2013 opera, commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera, called Two Boys. There's an excerpt, I'm Only 16. It's an aria sung by the character Brian, here Paul Appleby, sings about the internet.
A real place, better than, because it's real, there are people in
Paul Appleby singing the role of Brian in Nico Muhly's 2013 opera at the Met, Two Boys. I'm Only 16. They're talking about singing about the internet. There's a world, a real place, better because it's real. There are people in there, people of all kinds, and my parents can't see. Nico Muhly, all right, let's use your lenses on this, then, venue and tradition. What is the meaning of those when we listen to this song?
Well, in this particular case, I mean, I think it's accessing, as you can clearly hear, the tradition of grand opera, right? So his is a traditional tenor voice being deployed traditionally. And the, you know, the orchestration is, I would say, you know, it's sort of luxuriously traditional.
Mm-hmm.
And the topic, in a strange way, I mean, despite the fact that what he's talking about is a sort of primitive landscape of multiple chat rooms, it's something that I think opera has engaged with since the beginning of the form, which is this sense that disguise can be deployed sort of erotically, and it can be deployed mm-hmm. To mess with class, and it can be deployed to mess with sort of romantic entanglements. And what you end up with, I think, with the early sort of Wild West days of the internet, is something very, very akin to the sort of masked ball tradition, right? Where the peasant woman actually is dressed up as the mm-hmm. princess, and the
yep.
princess is, for whatever reason, hiding, you know.
That's great, yes.
As a man, you know, et cetera.
I see exactly what you mean, and still I wonder, when we talk about this tradition, I mean, Pink Floyd, maybe you could say, and Tommy sort of started down this road of thinking about some of these things. Here you are putting in the grand opera tradition. Does that tradition stay relevant forever? You know, maybe in another 100 years we'll be writing about, I don't know what. Well, people are already writing operas about human brains being put into computers. But there's an archaic sound to grand opera. Is it always relevant to contemporary life?
This is a great question. I mean, I think the way to answer it is to say, I mean, I would answer it personally and saying unequivocally yes. And I think when you if you go to the opera, particularly actually if you go to the opera maybe for the first or second time, it should be, if it's done well, it should be shockingly relevant to you. If the production is sort of working well and the singers are communicating the material and you know the material is something that you're loosely in some way interested in. It should communicate, and it should be really relevant, and it can be, at its best, the most magical of all the art forms. And I'm speaking specifically about grand opera, just because the number of people involved, and the layers, and the summation of design and of music and of a sort of raw emotional energy of the singers, it really can sort of blow you away. Whether or not the sort of business model of it can sustain, that's a very, very different question. But I think anyone would agree when you go that it's really quite overwhelming.
Listen, I love it, and I'm seldom happier. And still this question of its ongoing relevance is just interesting to me. You know, people dress up for fox hunting, let's say, or, you know, in old-fashioned hunting kit. And we know that they're – or Civil War reenactors. We know they're doing
right.
something old. You know, when they play – even polo, they call it the myopia club when they
right.
play sometimes. Why bring the old form to the new arena? What's the importance of doing that?
Well, I would lightly disagree. I mean, mm-hmm. I think, you know, yes, that there are things that belong to another generation. But if you open the door to any music school, if you go to NEC or if you go to
England Conservatory, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or Boston Conservatory or to you know, to Juilliard or to Manhattan School, there are tons of 18-year-olds
yeah.
who are absolutely ready to jump into the fire of opera, both chamber and grand. And something got to them, you know, while they were teens or before that.
Yeah.
So I'm actually never quite convinced when people say, you know, yes, it is a thing that belongs to older generations in a sense that it's not like NASCAR. But, you know, there are plenty of young people, almost a surfeit of young people engaged in it.
And in a way, that's its own – it hardly needs more justification than that. If people want to do it and people want to listen to it, what else is there to say?
What else is there to say? Exactly. I think there's a big cultural anxiety about opera, mainly due to people's own sort of hang-ups about mm-hmm. about you know, what it is and who it's for. And I think for me that the only thing I can do, I mean, my only job is to write, is to make the music good and to speak honestly about how I'm making it, to try to demystify it slightly so it doesn't feel like I'm working in this kind of sort of, you know, obscure kind of alchemy science lab way, but instead being, this is exactly what I'm thinking, this is the topic, this is how I'm engaging with it. So transparency with the hope of it becoming more alluring.
Were you, when you wrote Two Boys, were you channeling, I don't know, You Tell Us, great opera greats from centuries ago? Was it something wholly contemporary in your creative corner?
It's, I mean, as I said before, Two Boys – is a new delivery system for a very old drug, mm-hmm. right? Which is that when you put on a disguise, you can tell someone something and you can hear something that's much more true than when you're in your regular clothes. And this is the thing about the internet, of course, right? Is that you can have complete and three-dimensional emotional relationships with someone online, and you can both think that the person on the other end of the line is you know, a 26-year-old mm-hmm. man from Greece, but it turns out that it's a 55-year-old woman from Madison, Wisconsin. You know, it's
right.
But the question is, does the identity of the person make the sentiment any less true, right? And this is a very old thing in opera, and this is something you see in Handel operas, where it, you know, it's the added complexity of women playing men who dress up as women,
yes.
to mess with, you know, the duke of the neighboring you know, empire.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something very, very old-fashioned. So for me, I sort of engaged in it that way. But then also, in terms of you know, contemporary anxieties about identity, I was really interested in channeling, as you say, the work of Benjamin Britten.
Mm-hmm.
And Britten's operas always have at the heart this kind of anxiety and have this thing slightly in the periphery. And I thought a lot about his opera Peter Grimes, and I thought a lot about Death in Venice as an attempt to sort of give an emotional sheen from the sort of 40s, 50s, and 60s to the work.
Nico Muhly, stand by. It's so great to have you with us. We're going to hear a lot more behind us right here. Nico Muhly's 2015 Cello Concerto, Part 1. It's just terrific to have you here. Listeners, you can join us. Are you hungry for some musical interpretation of the world these days other than pop? Is this it? 800-423-8255 is our number, 800-423-TALK, with contemporary classical composer, arranger Nico Muhly. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with contemporary classical music composer and arranger Nico Muhly. One of his compositions, Two Boys, an opera commissioned by the Metropolitan Opera. A little bit of it right here behind us. Chat room whispers in Two Boys, Act 1, Scene 4. The opera takes on the real story of a 16-year-old English boy who nearly killed a younger boy, egged on the attacker claimed by mysterious people he encountered in an internet chat room. Doesn't get more relevant than that. If you heard all the Slender Man talk in American news in recent months, kids egged on to violence on the web. Nico Muhly joins us from New York today, and it's so great to have him with us. You can join us as well. Does this music speak to you? What do you want? What do you expect from a serious composer these days? And classical music lovers, does this contemporary classical speak to you? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Nico, you said a couple of minutes ago that if it's done well, grand opera should be shockingly relevant to someone in the audience today. I had that experience just a couple of months ago in Prague at the opera. La Boheme was on. It was just too damn relevant to me. It was cathartic, tears, and all the rest. I wish it hadn't been so relevant. What about for you, popular music versus classical versus contemporary classical? Where do you get the greatest access to your shockingly relevant emotions, responses to the world? In what form?
That's a very good question, actually. I've never really thought to make a hierarchy of it. You know, for me, the thing that always does it is I would say the choral music of the 15th and 16th centuries. I find an enormous beauty in the specificity of that music and in the fact that it's not concert music at all, right? It's music that's meant for not just sort of worship, but also it's keyed to dates in the liturgical calendar. So the idea is that you could only hear it once a year, if that, right? So you would hear these things, you know, on the second Sunday after Easter, and then mm-hmm. not again for another 3 years. And the specificity of that and the preciousness of it, I find really, really moving. So for me, I would say if there's an ultimate musical experience for me, it's kind of ducking into a church, you know, usually in England, but also you can find this in the States, actually particularly in Boston, and there'll just be a sort of hour-long thing in the afternoon, sort of evensong, yeah. and then you'll find sort of three little – and these sort of Magnificat and Nuctamita settings and then an anthem, and they're just the best.
I have a piece of your music here that might be relevant to that observation. This is A Good Understanding, 2010, performed by the Los Angeles Master Chorale. We'll listen to a little bit, but you tell us first, is this what your version of what you're talking about there, Nico?
That piece can be used in service, but it was actually designed for a church choir's concert. The only reason you wouldn't do it in a service is because it has a big drum in it. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure there are places that wouldn't mind that at all.
Let's listen a little bit. A Good Understanding from Nico Muhly, 2010. Los Angeles Master Chorale with Nico Muhly's 2010, A Good Understanding. And yes, we hear that big drum and we hear that beauty. Contemporary classical composer Nico Muhly joins us from New York. And Nico, we have callers for you. Paul in Augusta, Georgia. Paul, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Nico Muhly.
Hi, Paul.
Yes, thank you. I just have a comment. I'm not an opera listener or opera fan. Actually, jazz is my thing. But I was really struck by the question that you posed, Tom, just before the break. You know, is there a music today available that, besides pop, that can give us, you know, an interpretation that we respond to? And mm-hmm. I pulled up to the stoplight and hear Nico Muhly's cello concerto, I believe. It was just remarkable, the effect that it had on me. I just heard a complexity and a depth in the music, you know, tension and release and ascent and descent that was really, really moving. And I felt suddenly somehow at peace. I'm not sure why. I don't think you can explain what music does to you, but it did something to me, and I really liked it.
Paul, may I ask,
are you
a frequent classical music listener that who might therefore be sort of ready to enter this realm, or did it blindside you?
Well, actually, I was trained, if you can call sophomore year in college, a music major, and then not. But yes, I guess I have an ear for it, and I play jazz. So I'm you know, musically attentive and all of that sort of thing.
Paul, thank you so much for your call. Nico, what portion of the, I don't know how to put this even exactly, but the listening public do you find has access to your music? If they're, you know, listening to Top 40 and Bruno Mars and all the rest, and suddenly you come on, what's your experience? I mean, this is not a foreign territory to you. You work with pop artists as well. Does everybody have access to your music, or are some ears just not open to it, some minds?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, and I think, you know, Paul, you know, thank you, Paul, if you're still listening, for your kind words. Paul is a great example of people who sometimes have a sort of a lateral pathway in, where if you're interested in music, really any music, right, mm-hmm. and you have a kind of, you have, I would say, anything just a little passageway into any music, I feel like you should be able to find your way to what I'm up to and what a lot of my colleagues are up to. And I think because, you know, the advantage of us being the age that we are, and I'm saying anyone between maybe, you know, 15 years old and maybe 40, is that we post-date, I would say, a big anxiety about classical music existing in this sort of sealed environment. And mm-hmm. I think that the idea is that now, you know, now that there aren't record stores, It's much easier, actually, to sort of glide around from one thing to another. I don't know if you remember. I mean, when I was a kid, I used to take the bus from Providence to the Tower Records
in Boston,
yeah. Right. And I don't know if you remember, but it was like if you wanted to buy classical music, you had to go into what essentially felt like the porn room.
Yes.
Right? It was like a special area.
Right.
And then you felt weird, right? Because it was like a different environment and the people, you know, it was like slightly colder and the people who worked there had like an attitude.
Right. Yes.
And then, God forbid,
what are you doing
here? Well, right, exactly. And then, God forbid, you had to go into that opera room, which is like where they keep the really perverse stuff, you know. And the people in there were wearing khakis covered in relish and muttering to themselves setting up little altars in front of the Maria Callas.
Please,
but you know, it was a terrifying place. Big shopping bags filled with,
and now it's just a click, 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 and you're there. And now you can have the relish spilled on your PJs. Grace in Bloomington, Illinois, the one and only Bloomington, Illinois. Grace, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Grace.
Hi, thank you. I just wanted to say I really appreciate what you're doing, that you're still actively composing opera. I'm actually in the middle of a romantic era unit with my students, and I found out from talking to them that they really had no experience. They'd never seen opera before. They grew up in the same part of the state that I did, which is in the middle of a cornfield. So,
me too, Grace. Right there in Bloomington, you can still enjoy opera.
Oh, yeah. They're from Buckley, so they live in the middle of a cornfield, and they saw opera for the first time on YouTube, and I had shown them the Figaro's aria from Rossini, and I was comparing it to, you know, trying to make it, talking about making it relevant for now. I said, what would you do if you were the guy that cut the hair for Brad Pitt? You'd say you were Brad Pitt's barber, and you love your job. So they kind of took it that way and really got a chuckle out of it. So they're starting to sort of see that it is different. So talking about putting a bug in their ears,
that is great.
Really fun to watch.
Great. So I should also say, if you have the inclination, the Met and I'm bringing them up first because they're sort of my home team. But the Met has this wonderful thing, which is Metropolitan Opera on Demand, and you pay them like a small service fee per month. But then whenever you want, you can watch hundreds of operas that they've recorded over the last sort of 40 years. It's really, really great, and I think it's a great educational tool as well, because you can just sort of scan through and sort of find the things that you want to listen to. But it's great, and it's complete opera. So you can watch, if you wanted to, you could watch kind of the whole Ring cycle from a variety of productions.
Right,
it's the future is now.
Grace, thank you. Let's hear another from your work, Nico. This is the only tune, part one, The Two Sisters, from Mother Tongue, 2008 album, based on a folk murder ballad. Sam Amidon singing here.
There were two sisters walking down the There were two sisters walking down by stream. There were two sisters walking down by stream. There were two sisters walking down by a stream. Oh, the wind and the rain. The older one pushed the younger one in.
Nico Muley, The Two Sisters. Nico, we just get to nip in and out here. Give us some context for this. Help us.
So this is a piece called The Only Tune, and it's a piece that is actually very sort of dear to me. Essentially, what I wanted to do was analyze one of these old ballads, one of these old folk ballads. And this is a famous one. It exists in a million different versions from Europe and from the East Coast of America. Uh-huh. And it tells the story of two sisters who are walking around, and for whatever reason, the older one pushes the younger one into the river, and the younger one's body floats downstream, at which point it's picked up by a miller, and for one reason or another, he ends up turning her corpse into a violin, and the only song that the violin could play was the thing that she was singing as she got pushed in by her sister.
Oh,
and it's one of these horrible stories that in a lot of cases is sung in sort of the American folk tradition with a great big smile.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always found that element of the folk tradition to be very odd, that there's a deep violence to much of the material.
Yes.
But there's not really a violence to the performance. So I was interested in taking Sam Amidon, who I think has one of the great voices of our generation, He grew up singing folk music with his family. Both his parents are folk singers, and his brother as well. And so I was interested in using his voice and taking this song and exploding it into these three large sections to really explore this text, right? And what does it sound like to butcher a body and turn it into an instrument? What is the sort of mechanism of, you know, a human bone violin?
Yeah. Nico, what do you think it is that leads us to put that big folk singer smile on even those violent lyrics? What's that about?
Well, I think
is that here spit in your eye right. at fate and the difficulty of the world, or?
I think it's performance practice too, though. I think it's a sort of a way in which a lot of this music has been passed down, has been in a sort of joyful fashion, especially in the American tradition. I mean, I have recordings of some very angry old Scottish ladies singing the same things. It's slightly different, but I think the converse of this, of course, is that classical music needs to be not fun, right? And it needs to feel like hard work, and it needs to feel like it needs to have sort of scientific rigor. And I sort of reject that too, because I feel like there is there is and should be a sort of folksy ecstasy that you can find in playing classical music, and especially in playing sort of Bach. I feel like the way that Bach is talked about so reverentially, it just feels so crazy to me, because I feel like Bach is completely joyful and completely and should be very casual and expertly casual.
Let Bach be expertly casual. We'll listen to a little Muley. This is from 2012, Drones and Viola. Muley on piano there, Nadia Sirota on the viola. William in West Hartford, Connecticut, you're on with Nico Muley.
Hi, William.
Thank you. As a professional singer, I've had the opportunity to perform a number of roles by Benjamin Britten, and I attended the performance of Two Boys. I was transfixed by the spectacle and the sound. And then when we got to the inspector's aria, it was a magical moment, and I felt this sort of moving joy, much like it did the first time I heard the embroidery aria. Can you tell a little bit about how Benjamin Britten has influenced your compositional style?
Absolutely, and thank you again for your kind words. I mean, with me, Britten feels like he's finding a sweet spot between complete emotional expression and complete emotional reserve. And there's a magical moment, and I feel like in many of his operas, and I think a great example is in The Turn of the Screw, for instance, where you have this beautiful moment where the little boy Miles sings this sort of invented song, right? And it feels like he's not giving the whole thing away. It's just it's beautiful, but it's understated. And then, of course, that melody comes back at the end at the boy's death, sung by the governess, and it is the most exquisite release. And I feel like one of the things that I was interested in doing in Two Boys is always holding back a little bit with the arias and never quite letting them really soar, because in a sense it's a policier, right? So you're following this kind of, it's basically a big episode of Law and Order. You never want to go nuts in the first half. You have to kind of withhold. And I think with Britten you see that all the time. And I think you see that even in his last opera in A Death in Venice, where it just suddenly at the end, right, all that gamelan scale, all that stuff comes to an actual climax.
Nico Muley, it is so terrific to have you with us. Please stand by there in New York. Contemporary classical music composer, arranger, has worked with all kinds of wonderful groups and pop artists, indie rock artists. We'll look a little bit at that. Behind us right here, Music Under Pressure, One Flute from his 2010 album, I Drink the Air Before Me. Listeners, are you hungry for some musical interpretation of the world these days other than pop and classical music lovers? Does this contemporary classical speak to you? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. Glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind us, Nico Muhly's score for the 2008 Best Picture-nominated movie, The Reader. Kate Winslet won a Best Actress Oscar for her performance in that movie. That was the piece, Who Was She? Nico Muhly's work from the score for The Reader. Nico Muhly joins us today from New York, and you can join us as well. What do you see as the role of a contemporary classical music composer today? What's your question for Nico? What do you hear in his sound, his work? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Brian in Montreal, Canada. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Nico. Really glad to hear this kind of music. I'm thrilled to hear it. I've never been exposed to it before, and I'm certainly going to look for it. I wanted to throw out, you talked about the business model of opera and how it may not fit. I have a lifelong experience of music, as well as a lifelong in engineering and technology. And it's my childhood friends who started in the tone row era trying to write computer music that was, you know, atonal in the Austrian school tradition. I'm just wondering, have you looked at some of the ways that operatic type performance has been used here in Quebec, which has European links that are stronger than America? Robert Lepage, for example, comes out of here. He starts by making vast public spectacles that are largely tourist draws, but they're music as well as visual arts. And I'm wondering whether you have looked at those as ways of bringing your music to a larger audience. And one final contribution. I look at the space program and the money that's spent on them as also large operatic projects. Just for example, the Dawn project that just approached Ceres, remember all these
classical
references? Yeah, yeah. It did a Dance of the Spheres for 7.5 years. And if you go on NASA's website, you'll see this amazing number of pirouettes this little craft did to get to Ceres. Anyway, how are you going to market your wonderful music when these vast amounts of money for public display are going so many other places?
Oh, Brian, I love it. Nico, are you up against the space program of Celestial
Opera? That is a great series of questions, and thank you for them. I should say, you know, Robert Lepage is one of a fascinating artist, and you know he's worked in New York at the Met. He did a Damnation of Faust, and of course he did the Ring Cycle a few years ago, and the sort of, I mean, I think in that sense it was a very public spectacle, as any performance of The Ring is. I mean, I'm actually very interested artistically. I shouldn't even say marketing or business model, because honestly, I don't know anything about either of those things. But artistically, I'm very interested in making work in public spaces. I've been actually trying to convince the City of London to let me score this horrible underpass that you have to walk through to get to the Barbican. So I've been trying to convince them to let me do that for years. I would be, you know, another thing that I keep on hoping someone will ask me to do is to redesign all the beeping noises that the MetroCard machines take in New York, just so you don't have to listen to that one thing all day.
Yes.
Or airport chimes. I mean, if you want to get the people at the Montreal airport to call me, they can get my number. I really feel like one of the things that music can do is you can really modify the spaces in which we all live. And you can do that by insisting on beautiful things when the default is very unbeautiful. I was going to say something like the space program, you know, and particularly the way that social media has helped refocus attention on not just people in space, but, you know, the Hubble telescope. I think we're as it's it's as interesting to us now as it must have been growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, and I think, of course, about my older relatives who, you know, I mean, I know people who drove to watch the shuttle launch. You know, that the romance of that thing, I think, is coming back. And I feel like, of course, there's a place for music in that.
Well, but what about the notion that at some level you're competing with that kind of public spectacle, whether it's space program or war? Or is the artist, the musician's role, something quite different? Is that material to you, or is it potential competition?
Honestly, you know, 5 seconds ago was the first time it occurred to me that there would be a competition. I mean, I feel like also, you know, one thing that I'm always wary of is to talk about classical music or to talk about any music as being a competition. I think, you know, and there's a lot of I would say sloppy sort of misuse when people say, oh, you know, what does it feel like to throw your hat in the ring, or what does it feel like to have a dog in that fight? And I feel like, you know, I'm not quite sure that opera is a dog fight. You know, I think that the magic thing about being an artist is that there really is room for everyone. And I think, you know, there's an anxiety about being denied exposure or about being denied funding or whatever. But I think if you look at kind of the great success stories of composers who were themselves denied funding by the powers that be, I'm thinking specifically of Philip Glass, who just said, all right, if there's no room for me at this table, I'm going to build my own table. And then, of course, look what happened. You know, I think there's always space for coexisting without competing.
You found some space at the table of Björk, or she with you. Of course, the famous Icelandic artist is a little bit from that. This was 2004. Niko Muli playing piano on this DVD version of the single called Oceania.
Every boy is a snake, is a lily. Every pearl is a sweet like harmony, made into flesh. You dance by my side, children sublime.
Niko Muli playing piano there behind Björk. Just listening, you two seem made for one another. What is that connection, Niko?
This is actually a very interesting project. I mean, she called me very, very last minute and got my number through a friend of a friend and was like, look, I've got this crazy piano part and I've got it as MIDI, but I really want to realize it as this kind of like Tom and Jerry, like Liberace thing. So, I mean, it was all her vision, and I was just kind of a servant to it. And I think one of the things that makes her so interesting, and I, you know, there's been a lot of talk about her recently because she just released this big album.
Yes.
She is a top-down composer. I mean, she thinks about the song and the arrangement of the song and the instruments of the song and all these things at once. So it's not, let me write a song and then add an arrangement to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's all part of a piece. And then, of course, on top of that, she has, you know, the voice. I mean, that voice is something that, I mean, for me, and I think for a lot of people, it sounds like the call is coming from inside the house. It's just like, it's the most direct form of communication.
Are you a top-down composer in those terms?
Well, I mean, I work alone, so I have to be. I mean, I think the difference, the thing that's important, again, to point out about Björk is that she's sort of the same way, despite the fact that there's a lot of people around. It's it really is her vision. It's not, you know, it's funny. I just wrote a review that was published maybe, you know, a couple of hours ago of Madonna's new album. And one of the interesting things is I got, first of all, I love the album. But second of all, I got sent a list of the credits of everyone who was involved. And it was like, it's like a movie list. I mean, it's five pages long. Yeah. There's a million people happening, and I think you'll find in artists like Björk, it's really the opposite. It's like it's a couple of really curated collaborators, but it really is her vision from the top. Very, very much like what I think other composers would do for a large project.
I mean, you say I work alone, but one of your reputations is for working kind of in community, working with people, not just shut up in a garret composing privately.
Right. Well, I think when I say I work alone, I mean more in, you know, half of one's life as a composer is this scary thing where you're handed a stack of money and the expectation is that you will turn that money into a stack of paper and that no one will interfere with you. during that process.
Yeah.
So writing, for instance, symphonic music is very much that, where it's like, this is the deadline, this is how many minutes we want, here's a stack of money, give us a stack of paper. and then so for me, I found that one way to get more excited about working that way, which I do like doing, but is to take on completely different collaborative projects in which you really are kind of in a hammock and at the mercy of the weather. And I think, you know, I just finished this large project with the guitarist and composer Bryce Dessner and Sufjan Stevens, who's a composer and singer and songwriter and blah 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 blah, and the three of us are in a weird way perfectly mismatched, because it means that we're all constantly out of our comfort zones. And in a constant state of sort of half finishing things and allowing room for someone else to finish it. And it really feels like maybe, you know, three people meeting in a rented house somewhere and trying to make a big dinner in the best way.
It feels very contemporary somehow. I don't have that. I do have this, you with Grizzly Bear, the indie rock band out of Brooklyn. This is back in 2009, song Cheerleader off the album Vecatimist, you working on the choral arrangement. Nico Muhly and indie rockers Grizzly Bear there for a sense of his range. Alex in Wrentham, Massachusetts, you're on with Nico.
Hey, Alex.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Nico. Hi, Tom. I just had to call. I've never had such an exciting morning listening to your show. When I was a kid, I have distinct memories of sitting in the car, long road trips, and composing classical music in my mind. Like, I could hear my own orchestra, and I thought, oh, you can't do that anymore, because, you know, classical music composers are dead, it's all been done. So this is just such a thrill.
Oh, thank you so much. And I went to high school in Providence, and I had a friend who worked at the Wrentham outlets, and we were always there.
All right.
So it's nice to hear someone from Wrentham. Well, I'm sorry that you limited it to the car. I mean, it is a real thing, and people are doing it. It's a strange and specific thing, and I always feel like, you know, if you have a kid who's expressing any interest in especially writing music, but really anything with music, if it's like, you know, they're obsessed with the oboe, I feel like, you know, encourage. Drop them off at Symphony Hall for an evening.
Alex, thanks so much for your call. I want to go back a little bit further to a gift. 2006 debut album speaks volumes. On there we had a Hudson Cycle written as a wedding gift for two of your friends. Here it is from Nico Muhly. Nico, you went to Juilliard. You worked with Philip Glass for a long time. I wonder how do you look at the most important thing you bring to your creative work? Is it training? Is it something else?
That's a really good question. Actually, I've never really thought of making a list of, like, it's not like a BuzzFeed listicle of, you know, five most important things I bring to my work. I found, you know, I love training. I sort of miss it, actually. I impose little tasks on myself, and I still soulfish through scores every day, and I still do score study, you know, many, many times a week for many hours. Training is great. Training can never be bad. But I think the thing that makes the energy behind everything I do is simultaneously sort of curiosity and obsessiveness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that, you know, in one's personal life perhaps needs to be put under control. But in the music I make, I can really obsess, and I can allow myself to zoom really into a little idea. And that's, I mean, in fact, this music that we're hearing now, A Hudson Cycle, is really just about one rhythmic thing. It's about sort of, you know, two against three in the other hands, and with hiccups in it. And it's this idea of a constantly moving surface that has occasional sort of electrical jolts sent through it.
Do you think of yourself as interpreting the world or giving voice to some kind of timeless human soul or souls? Is it outward looking or inward?
I think it's a combination of both. I mean, I feel like also with those bigger questions about what music is and what it means to write it, you know, I've always felt like it starts inward, and if the inward process is really honest, the outward part will take care of itself. I'd like to think that that's true. And in a sense, it's sort of like if you deal with your own relationship to the world and to the function of music, whether or not that's sacred music or public music, as we were talking about before, mm-hmm. or music that's you know on a recording, or music that's part of an opera, or music that's a gift, or music that's a you know a torment. Mm-hmm. If your relationship with those things is under control, then it should radiate out through you and to the performers, who of course have to realize the music. And this is another thing I'm always really willing to happy to point out, which is that, you know, I can only take it so far as a composer. I need performers to realize my quote unquote vision. What you're listening to right now is this piece called Balance Problems, which is written for sort of six of my best friends. And you know, I wrote the piece knowing that it was for them, and knowing that it needed them to make it really sing.
No shortage of performers at the ready to work with you these days, and we can all hear why. What a pleasure this has been. Niko Mealy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.